I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. We often associate the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormonism, with Brigham Young and Salt Lake City. But there is an earlier history of the church that took place east of the Mississippi River, an origin story that includes prophecy, bloodshed, and religious persecution, all revolving around the founder of the Mormon Church, Joseph Smith. In a new book, author Alex Beam sheds light on this charismatic and polarizing religious figure and documents Smith's use of secret rituals, the power of revelation, and polygamous marriage to build what eventually became the largest native religion in America. Beam paints Smith as a controversial figure who blended religion, politics, and social organization into a remarkably powerful leadership position at the head of the Mormon Church. But Smith also created many enemies along the way, and Beam carefully chronicles the days leading up to Smith's jailhouse assassination in Carthage, Illinois in 1844. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about Joseph Smith and the Mormon Church. Let's hear from you. Are you a Mormon currently living in the Granite State? What's your take on the Joseph Smith story? Have you ever visited any of the historic sites for the Mormon religion? Let's hear your questions for Alex Beam on Joseph Smith and the legacy of Mormonism. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And you can post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me from Boston this morning is Alex Beam. Alex is a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of a new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. And Alex, welcome to The Exchange.
Dean, thank you very much for having me.
Now, Alex, I told my producers after reading your book, I think I have enough questions for about a three-hour show. But alas, we must keep it to 1 hour. So let's start with a general question about the project. Why decide to write an entire book about what is essentially a 14-year period in the early history of the Mormon Church? Is there a dearth of scholarship on this particular period in the church? And I should also note for our curious listeners that you're not actually a member of the Mormon Church. So what was your rationale for writing this book?
Right. The fact is that this is a work of popular history about Joseph Smith's killing. There is no book, no nonfiction book about Joseph Smith's killing out there. It was actually seen, and I hate to be so crass, but it was seen as an editorial opportunity. It was seen as an extremely violent story taking place on the American frontier, had this curious admixture, this kind of sexual overlay, because as you know, one of the reasons Smith's own followers rebel against him is that they rebel against his revelation concerning polygamy. And sort of lastly, it was noted, not by me, I should say, but by a clever editor, that the Smith's, I'm not trying to be sort of crass, but Smith's killing takes place in an extremely compact timeline. The sort of the mini rebellion against Smith takes place on June 7th, 1844, and he's a dead man by June 27th of 1844. So, to tell a historical story in a very tight time frame, with sex, violence, and religion, what can I say? So it was very, very tempting.
So it sounds like, you know, the question of the history of Mormonism aside, this sounds like it was the makings of a good, exciting historical read.
That's exactly right. It was meant to be a readable, accurate work of popular history, which I think it is.
Yeah, and I will say, you mentioned the compactness of the assassination. For our listeners, if you check out the book, roughly I think it's about the last 100 pages, is almost like an hourly TikTok of the lead up to kind of the mob assassination of Joseph Smith. And it's really almost like watching an action movie in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, and that's that was just very, very appealing, because The real problem, of course, the real challenge of the book is to get to the beginning of the TikTok, because I, like I think almost every reader coming to this book, you know, simply doesn't know why is Joseph Smith in Illinois on the banks of the Mississippi River with 12,000 Mormon followers? How in heaven's name did he get there?
Right. And that's actually a very nice segue to my next question. You know, like me, I think some of our listeners may know that Joseph Smith was born just across the Connecticut River in Sharon, Vermont. I also did not know that Brigham Young was born in Vermont, which apparently he was. They may not really know the story of how the Book of Mormon came into being in 1830. Could you give us just a brief account of the Revelation story, you know, the Golden Tablets, the Angel Moroni, Smith's use of scribes, those sorts of, just to sort of give us a sense of how this all got up and running in New York State?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's it rates about a sentence and a half in every work of American history. But Joseph Smith's family moved from Vermont to Palmyra, New York, to what's called the burned over district, an area of tremendous religious ferment in the beginning of the 19th century. And as a young teenager, it is said Joseph Smith was religiously curious. He didn't understand how come there were four different churches in Palmyra if there were only one God. And beginning at age 15, he said he had visitations from, you know, holy visitors, angels, Jesus Christ, and so on, you know, leading to the angel Moroni says to him, I will show you a new true Bible. This prompts Joseph, as many of your listeners know, to go to the hill Cumorah and to unearth the so-called golden tablets upon which are inscribed the Book of Mormon in a language called Reformed Egyptian. And to make the story even sort of more involved, Joseph doesn't claim to understand Reformed Egyptian. He views the plates through special spectacles. I realize the story is becoming slightly more outlandish. But in any case, he views the plates or doesn't view the plates through these spectacles, at which point he dictates by revelation the entire text of the Book of Mormon, both to his wife, Emma, who's separated from him in a room by a curtain, and also to Oliver Cowdery, one of many scribes, which, as you mentioned, Joseph will spend most of the rest of his life using a scribe. Joseph himself, no one really knows how literate he is. He's somewhat literate, but he uses scribes for most of his writing chores, including his diary, which starts to be very informative in
so
the last 10 years of his life.
Do you have – I try to get a sense of whether or not anyone else actually saw the golden tablets. Emma, his wife, says that she saw them, but then you find out towards the end of the book that she saw them wrapped in cloth, I think, and she actually moved them but said she never actually looked at them. So he had these scribes, but weren't they sort of walled off by a curtain, or am I misunderstanding that?
No, you're understanding it correctly. However, we're approaching a very fine point of Mormon history, which is that Joseph initially assembled three witnesses. In fact, I mean, just to make it simple, if any of your listeners were to go to a Marriott hotel anywhere in America, he or she would find the Book of Mormon, you know, in the drawer underneath the telephone. And if you go to the back of that book, you'll see the list of three witnesses followed, I believe, by the list of eight witnesses. The first three witnesses, I believe, are all family members of Joseph Smith's. So in any case, and then several of them left the church, so he had to go find more witnesses. Several of the eight witnesses then left the church. This is extremely delicate and controversial area of Mormon doctrine that I'm not 100% conversant on. In any case, Joseph realized that he needed to have people who would purport to be witnesses. Some of them later said that they were metaphorical witnesses only.
And so now this just the sort of the larger point of the kind of the development of the Book of Mormon and Mormonism, and this is taking place in the context of the kind of second great religious awakening in the early 19th century, was essentially, if I understand the story correctly, to prepare for the second coming of Christ sometime in the late 1800s. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the Book of Mormon is you know, Harold Bloom of Yale University would be the first to agree, is sort of a breakthrough text in the context of the Second Great Awakening, because it's the only serious sort of document or Bible to emerge from that period of religious ferment. And also, of course, it, you know, astonishingly brings the story of Jesus Christ to the North American continent. And yes, it also, you know, it proclaims that you know, Joseph hedged on this, as do all millennial preachers. Of course, he thought that perhaps his followers would see the exaltation or the second coming of Christ in his lifetime. Later, he had to back off that.
And then one sort of final point of revelation, Garden of Eden. The Mormons view it as located in or around Independence, Missouri. Is that correct?
Yes, there's a beautiful field there. I tend to get this name wrong. I think it's called Adamonan, and I apologize if I have that wrong. But it's a lot of the locus of the Book of Mormon is in North America, and Joseph proclaimed that Independence, Missouri, was the Zion of his people, and he would eventually attempt to move his people to Independence.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually literally a field that you can actually go and see.
Yeah, it's photographed ever so often. I mean, by the Salt Lake Tribune or by the Deseret News. I believe it's a semi holy place in contemporary Mormonism.
Fascinating. Well, that's a sort of very helpful kind of background for the actual drama that you depict from 1830 to 1844. Let's switch gears a little bit and start talking about Joseph Smith himself, his personality. I think at one point in the book, I love you describe him as an operatic personality, which I thought was a great way to describe him. I mean, he really seems to be a host of contradictions, and he was certainly polarized. Just maybe a little bit of a thumbnail about what he was like personality-wise. He seems like a conflicted individual in the story.
Well, he's an individual who attracts conflict. He's very hard to get one's arms around.
Right.
He's much easier to make fun of. Of course, he's mercilessly lampooned in the musical The Book of Mormon. I felt, and indeed, you know, I think reasonable people feel that it's okay to make fun of him, but how do you explain the astonishing success of his ministry and his message? He seems to be a person of boundless energy. He seems to be a charismatic preacher. He shows elements of physical bravery several times in his life. There's more than one attempt to lynch him. Like Fyodor Dostoevsky, he faced a firing squad that ultimately didn't kill him. It was a truly operatic life. His followers, even Brigham Young, everyone had mixed feelings about him, but also had a sort of a profound love for Joseph the Prophet, while at the same time understanding that this was a person who drank whiskey, who liked to wrestle in the dust with young people. When you hear contemporary faithful Mormons, they express an actual love for Joseph Smith.
We do need to take a brief break here, but we'll come back and talk more about Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormon Church. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good Thursday morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match your employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. Cloudy, some showers today. Could see some isolated thunderstorms. Today's highs in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, a member of SIPC. From Nashua Crossings Assisted Living and Memory Care Community, warm and inviting, with services provided by caregivers who love what they do. Tour information at nashuacrossings.com. And Lake Street Garden Center, specializing in plants grown for New England, celebrating 40 years with a new greenhouse. Lake Street Garden Center in Salem and at lakestreet.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam on his new book, American Crucifixion. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we are talking with Alex Beam. And Alex, before we go back to talking about Joseph Smith, we've received an email from Tracy, an interesting bit of local history here. And Tracy writes, the first settler of Marlow, New Hampshire was Solomon Mack, the maternal grandfather of Joseph Smith. He published an autobiography entitled A Narrative of the Life of Solomon Mack. He's buried in Centennial Cemetery in Gilsum, New Hampshire, and his daughter Lucy Mack Smith mother of Joseph Smith, was born there as well. And 2025 will be the 250th anniversary of her birth. So there is an interesting interesting local angle on today's story, another connection for
briefly,
us.
That is absolutely fascinating. I should just briefly say anyone with an internet connection can Google my name and Lucy Mack Smith. Of all things, I was asked to write a Mother's Day essay about Joseph Smith's mother. And I won't. First of all, thank you for reminding us about the Mack family. And secondly, Lucy Mack Smith is an extremely important figure in the history of her son. Sadly, she had to see her dead son for A. And B, she then wrote an incredibly important memoir of Joseph Smith's early years.
That's very, very interesting. It's not something I was aware of. It's great that you can actually go to the cemetery and see the history right there. I want to go back talking a little bit more about Joseph Smith. It was fascinating to me that, you know, not only was he a religious figure, but he was a general in his own kind of military legion. He wore almost a Napoleonic outfit. They did a lot of drilling. And, you know, one of the subplots of the end of the book is whether or not there was going to be retaliation by this legion, this military legion. And it seems like time and again they decided to leave rather than launch a strike for retribution.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting piece of Mormon history. Is, you know, when Joseph was with the Mormons in Missouri, an actual shooting war broke out. And the Mormons are not turn the other cheek kind of people. Although they lost dozens of church members in Missouri, they shot plenty of people themselves. And by the time they set up in Illinois, they had indeed they had their own army called the Nauvoo Legion, had between 2,000 and 3,000 members. They were, I mean, I think Thomas Ford, the governor, said it looked like a so-called fighting unit that spent a lot more time drilling than actually fighting. It's an interesting piece of Mormon history. I think I write that the Nauvoo Legion never fired a shot in anger, which I believe is true. It was an element of sheer terror in Hancock County, where Joseph had settled his entire flock, because all the non-Mormons were frightened, of course, most especially after Joseph's lynching. They were frightened that the Nauvoo Legion would march on other parts of Illinois and start killing non-Mormons.
Right. And in fact, you mentioned that they're not a turn-the-other-cheek kind of people. And I think you write in the book that for many years after the assassination of Joseph Smith, they were required as part of their ritual to swear this kind of oath of vengeance as part of the ceremony. Is that correct?
Yes, it's up until 1923 or 1927. My memory's not perfect right now. But fascinatingly, I mean, this started, since you've read the book, this started almost literally the day after Joseph was killed. The 12 apostles gathered and talked among themselves, and they said, we want to take vengeance on the United States of America for killing a true prophet of God. And of course, they left the United States of America. I know I'm anticipating here. They went to the Utah Territory. But up until 1927, every Mormon who went through the priesthood ritual, which only men can go through, only men indeed to our day can become actual elders, as it's called, members of the religion. And part of that ritual was to swear vengeance against the country that killed Joseph Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very interesting. And again, not the sort of martial aspect of it I was not at all aware of.
I'm just going to add one detail.
Absolutely.
I really apologize, because it to me it's like endlessly fascinating. As you also know from reading the book, that the Mormons actually thought that the American Civil War, was part of God's plan to venge himself on the United States for the killing of Joseph Smith.
Well, and I think you mentioned there were actually, Smith had a prophecy about the Civil War a few years before he died, and that sort of foresaw that this was going to happen at some point.
Yes, it's an unbelievable, a true prophecy and it's also quite literal and quite narrow and quite accurate.
Right. We mentioned in the opening that the Mormons were essentially chased from Ohio to Missouri to Illinois, and then they eventually moved way out to Salt Lake City. You know, one of the interesting undercurrents of the book for me as a political scientist was the uneasy relationship between Mormon society and virtually every level of government, whether it was local, state, or federal. You mentioned that in the book that Smith often petitioned Washington for reparations stemming from their, I guess when they were expelled from Missouri, they had a lot of property seized. And so they were constantly asking Washington to make good on that. And just kind of if you could talk a little bit about the uneasy relationship between kind of Mormon society and government and state and local and even federal. I mean, there are a lot of interesting characters, judges and governor and who pop up in this story as well. And it just seems almost like not a lawless time, but a very different time from what we would recognize today as the rule of law.
Yeah, well, I think you put your finger on something extremely important, not only about Mormonism in the 19th century, but also about Mormonism in the 20th century. And I'll try to be somewhat brief. But Joseph Smith, you know, curiously, was an incredibly patriotic American. At various times, I think he said the founders were inspired by God to write the Declaration of Independence. And starting with the depredations directed against the Mormons, mainly in Missouri, where they were killed and expropriated, I mean, he literally gets an audience with President Martin Van Buren. And I think he approaches the president, you know, in full good faith. And in fact, and he approaches various senators, and they all in D.C., they all tell him, tough luck, pal. You know, you were in a war. You made some people angry. You've lost all your property. Too bad. And at this point, begins a kind of dramatic turning away from American power on the part of Joseph and his followers. As you know, in 1844, he's running for president. I mean, he feels so strongly.
Another remarkable tidbit that I was not aware of, that he actually and he sent off all his advisors or his apostles, as they were called, around the country to basically stump for him, which is the way it was done back then.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, this is really important and I think has far-reaching implications even into the 20th century, and that Joseph had really lost faith in the United States of America. And so he had this idea he would run for president in 1844. If he didn't win in 1844, he'd win in 1848. If he didn't win in 1848, well, Jesus Christ was going to come and create the kingdom of God in any case, and the Mormons would be ruling the entire world. But, I mean, this puts the move to Utah in dramatic context, because in fact, the Mormons simply give up on the United States. Utah is owned by Spain at the time that they decide to essentially colonize it. They create a separate country completely outside of the United States. And I would argue, and I think there's a great book to be written, that Brigham Young then basically wages war against the United States for the last 50 years of the 19th century. I mean, this is a religion and a society that has had extremely problematical relationships with American government.
I guess we should mention that, you know, people are probably most familiar with that name, Brigham Young. He, as a result of Smith's death, there's this brief power struggle, and then he takes over and essentially, I think he's the head of the church for the next 30 years, and he decides to move them basically as far away as possible from all of the stuff that they were dealing with to rebuild the church, essentially.
Exactly. I mean, they view it as a biblical exodus. They take shelter in a desert, and the American cavalry at one point is like, you know, invades Utah with the mission to sort of, you know, get Brigham Young off his throne, and it fails. I mean, what happens in Utah in the 19th century is an insurrection, an ongoing insurrection. Of course, the history of the 20th century is the exact opposite. It's the Mormon Church's attempt to reintegrate itself.
Yeah, there's an interesting... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was there's an interesting element, kind of the political angle on all this, and in their relation, you know, their interaction, you know, as people who could vote in Illinois, and also in dealing with these different levels of municipal government, there seems to be an element of pragmatism in their decision making that they're almost criticized for. You know, they're basically kind of go with whichever party or whichever individual, you know, makes the most sense for them, and it seems almost like that was, you would think, so they're pragmatic, they kind of go along. But it actually seemed to kind of work against them a little bit.
Yeah, no, it earned them really the undying hatred of the residents of Illinois, because they voted as a block. And Joseph Smith knew that he controlled between 3,000 and 4,000 legitimate votes in Illinois, which some political scientists, I think, have possibly exaggerated that import. But I should say that there are theories out there that Joseph was killed because he effectively held the keys to Illinois' Electoral College votes. And then there's even been a whole book written on the thesis that by holding the keys to Illinois' Electoral College votes, maybe Joseph Smith held the keys to the United States elections. But in any case, they did have a tremendous political power in Illinois, and people despised them for it because their only voting principle was, you know, what's best for the Mormons.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, as a political scientist, the whole concept of group identity and voting, fascinating even in the early 19th century. I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking with Alex Beam, the author of a new book on Mormon founder Joseph Smith. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Alex, let's go to the phones now. And we have Rick joining us from Concord. Rick, welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, it's great to be on. I'm enjoying the show. And Alex, thanks for your research. I moved into an old house when we moved up here about 30 years ago, and it had a map on the wall, one of those illuminated maps of New Hampshire with all the little tiny figures skiing and saying things, and a lot of historical notes. And it has a picture of a man with a top hat and a suitcase that says "Be Young" on it, walking out of what looks like Peterborough. And he has a word balloon saying, "I may regret leaving." And so apparently Brigham Young lived in the Peterborough area, and when I researched it, it looks like he was notified of Joseph Smith's death while he was in New Hampshire. I'm just curious if you know anything. Why was he here?
I do know that. That's the second unbelievable pickup by Exchange listeners. I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't believe Brigham lived in Peterborough, New Hampshire. However, I mean, a true hinge moment in Mormon history is that Brigham Young, one of the 12 apostles, probably the most vigorous, is in Peterborough, New Hampshire, I believe in early July, when he learns of the death of Joseph Smith, the head of the church, which occurred on June 27th, 1844. News traveled. That's just the pace at which news traveled. This was immediately pre-telegraph. And Brigham, basically, as Dean pointed out, Brigham curiously was on a mission to New Hampshire to lobby for Joseph Smith, the presidential candidate, to get his name on the ballot, et cetera, et cetera. Probably also to do missionary work, because the Mormons had a significant stake—in Boston. So, I mean, Peterborough is a turning point in Mormon history, because Brigham immediately decides, he's with two other people, as I recall. He decides, I think it takes him 2 weeks to return to Nauvoo, Illinois. But he has a revelation, in fact, in Peterborough, that Joseph has spoken to him and that he believes that he, Brigham, should become head of the church.
Rick, thanks for that call. And I just want to remind our listeners one more time, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. You can even post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Alex, I want to shift gears again. We've talked now about Smith's personality. We've talked a bit about the political and social context of early Mormonism. One of the most interesting themes in the book, this is more on the religious end, the role of secrecy, ritual, and revelation, I thought was just fascinating. You say that Smith had 135 canonized revelations. And what I thought was particularly interesting was after he died, all the other key players all start having dreams and revelations as well about who should take over the church. Give me a sense of kind of the use of secrecy and ritual really as a way to build the organizational structure of the church.
Right. I have to say as a footnote, my understanding is, of course, that Joseph felt that the saints, you know, could have revelations themselves. It's an interesting part of church doctrine up until our times, as you know. Mormons still receive revelations at every level. I mean, secrecy is a very strange element in Joseph's life. He had, you know, polygamy was a secret. A really bad secret, you know, in retrospect. But, I mean, bad in every sense. Even, you know, a Freudian would say, if you're going to have a secret, it better not be sexual. He had secret governance committees in Nauvoo, Illinois, several of them. The most notorious is the so-called Council of 50. The Council of 50 records remain secret until our day, which is astonishing. He gathered 50 men, 47 of them Mormons, three of them Gentiles or non-Mormons. And these people would meet because they were anticipating how to govern the kingdom of God, which would be the world after the sort of re-arrival of Jesus Christ on our planet. He had the Council of the Anointed, you know, the Council of the Second Anointed. It's you would be, frankly, much better, you know, situated to comment on this kind of governance. It's in a sense, it's poisonous, of course. When you're ruled by secret committees, there were, to be fair, there were some open structures of governance as well. I don't know if this is where you're going with this, Dean, but I mean, you know, a crazy element, I think, of Joseph Smith's life in 1843 and 1844 is, of course, his embrace of Masonic ritual, which is a very well-known, broadly accepted in America, secret society.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was interesting to me because you mentioned that, you know, secrecy can be poison, and there's kind of the public story of the church, but then there's just this fascinating web of personal relationships between brothers, between in-laws, between family members that really is kind of driving the church. So everything is going on at two layers, and you know, we'll talk about polygamy in a moment, which really kind of was the secret that I think sounds like undid the early church and at least split it in half. But you know, as a result of this, you quote various newspaper editors and other politicians in the region who just, you know, viewed him as kind of a megalomaniac and a despot, and just really kind of vitriolic language that whips up the fervor that leads to his eventual assassination.
Yes, I mean, Smith is. I mean, the irony of him running for president, I tread fairly lightly there. I mean, you know, he knows he's a national figure, and his followers know that he's a national figure. What they don't seem to pick up is he's notorious, you know, rather than famous. He is known across America, but he's known as, you know, Joseph Smith and his Mormon seraglio. You know, he's known because rumors of polygamy have started to spread around the country, and indeed, I mean, the problem with secrecy is, of course, that his a lot of people apostatize from this church. A lot of top officials break with Joseph, and eventually they move elsewhere. They go to the newspapers. They write these unbelievably lurid books about Joseph and about Mormonism, which are very complicated because they're about, you know, they're between 58% and 48% true. So the Mormons, on the one hand, say, "Oh, we're being slandered by our enemies," but the problem is that there's some truth to all these kind of lurid accounts, and it doesn't bode well for Joseph.
Well, we need to take one more break, but after the break, we'll continue talking about Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormon Church, and Alex Beam's new book, American Crucifixion. This is The Exchange.
Of The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning, it's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the widening investigation into substandard care at veterans hospitals, and then new efforts to give patients easy access to their doctor's notes. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Cloudy with some showers for today. Could see some isolated thunderstorms, high temperatures in the 60s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Christopher P. Williams, Architects of Meredith, designers of energy-efficient, LEED-certified homes. Information at cpwarchitects.com and on Facebook. And Northeast Delta Dental, providing dental benefits to businesses of all sizes and individuals throughout New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Information online at nedelta.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. But today on The Exchange, we're discussing a new book on the early history of the Mormon Church. Join us with your thoughts by calling us at 1-800-892-6477. You can even find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or find us on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And you can continue the conversation there after the show as well. Alex, we have an email from Forrest, and he says, I think it's important in any discussion of Joseph Smith to include information about his criminal record. Also, didn't his wife throw away his first manuscript, daring him to replicate it in full, which he failed to do? So some interesting components of the story.
I'm tired of these listeners. Yes. Who know too much.
Very attentive listeners.
Let me briefly answer Forrest. First of all, Joseph Smith was prosecuted. I don't know the exact date. I'm guessing, let me just think, 1826. It's easy to find. In New York State, for treasure digging. I'll be very brief here, but I mean, not that it's not an important issue. It was really dug up, and I don't mean to be facetious, by Fawn Brody, I think Joseph Smith's greatest biographer, got the records of this trial. Because Joseph had this undistinguished and controversial background, you know, before he found the plates with the help of the angel Moroni, the Book of Mormon, he was a dowser, a scryer, and a treasure digger. He was he famously hired himself out to the father of his future wife, Emma, to find Spanish gold on Emma's father's property. Her father was a well-to-do person in Pennsylvania, and Joseph had a contract to find a trunk of Spanish gold. And of course, when he didn't find the gold, he said that phantoms had moved it, because he would say, "Here's the gold." People would dig, and they wouldn't find it, and he'd say phantoms had moved it. The second thing that Forrest is bringing to light is appallingly important, but hard to explain. There was indeed an initial 119 pages of the Book of Mormon that were lost. I don't know for a fact that his wife, consigned it to the fire, as Forrest is suggesting, but it was lost. It was never reconstituted, and the nightmare of Mormonism has always been that these 119 pages would surface, and of course would not correspond to the first 119 pages of the published Book of Mormon. I can't go on, although I could go on endlessly, because there's a famous Mormon forgery, of course, that purported to answer the question of the missing 119 pages.
Well, thanks, Forrest, for a very interesting email. Alex, we've sort of briefly mentioned polygamy, but I want to spend a few more minutes talking about it. I mean, this really seems in your book to be the undoing of the church as it exists in Illinois. We know that Brigham Young moves out west, and I think you say openly practices polygamy in the Utah territories. And there's a split, and there's a Reformed church that pops up in Illinois after Brigham Young moves out. Just say a little bit about the way in which the polygamy revelation, which it sounds like was both denied and accepted by Smith privately and publicly, how that played out.
Right. It's Smith claimed in a way to have been told by God fairly early in the game, in the 1830s already, that as part of the restoration of the New Testament teachings, that he should raise seed up to God by taking multiple wives, as did Abraham and his followers, King Solomon, or else King David, excuse me, notoriously had 700 wives. So this was sort of Old Testament revelation that Joseph sort of started rolling out in Nauvoo, Illinois, secretly in 1843. And it was a complete disaster, really. I mean, he approached William Clayton, his diarist, who kept his diary for him. He approached Brigham Young. Everyone he approached said, in a sense, you must be kidding. This is horrible. We're Christians. I'm lawfully wedded to my wife. In any event, because Joseph was a prophet of God, at least so he was viewed by his closest followers, they all eventually adopted the doctrine of polygamy. And in my book, and I hesitate to say, I mean, there are numerous salacious episodes, really, because, he approaches his closest followers, the Kimballs, and the Kimballs think, I see, okay, he wants to sleep with my wife. No, he wants to sleep with their daughter, their 16-year-old daughter, and does. So this creates just, you know, even a prophet of God can create some pretty serious problems. And, you know, some Mormons, a small minority, you know, rebel. You know, one of his greatest enemies, William Law, has this, I mean, again, has a very beautiful wife named Jane Law. And it appears that Joseph made a pass at Jane Law, and that was a very bad idea because she told her husband he was prosperous. In other words, he didn't need to fear Joseph Smith. He believed the doctrine of the Book of Mormon, but he didn't fear Joseph's power in any way, and he basically led the small rebellion against Joseph.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable. You detail, members approaching each other's wives and wanting to be spiritually wed to pairs of daughters. And I think you talk in the book how there's a, you know, some discussion among scholars about whether he had somewhere between 32 and 46, I think, is the figure roughly wives in his you know, fairly brief lifetime. Really, since he died at 39.
Right. I mean, it's coming under scrutiny now. There's been, you know, the Mormons are extremely defensive about polygamy, I mean, for understandable reasons. It is the official doctrine of the church in Utah. They first make it public in 1852, so it's a secret doctrine and really for 10 years in the church, and then it's eventually abolished. You know, they back away from polygamy in 1890 and the second time in 1910. But it's The numbers are strange because Joseph, it's called sealing. You know, he sealed himself to women both for time and for eternity. The women to whom he sealed himself for time, he intended to have conjugal relations with. And some older women, like Brigham Young's sister, he sealed himself only for eternity so that they would. You know, the idea was, of course, to create a huge family. That would be together to celebrate the arrival of Jesus Christ at the end of time.
You know, I found it fascinating how it just sort of undermines the social fabric of the community. Let's go to the phones, and we have joining us from Bridgewater, Paul. And Paul has a question about the name, Latter-day Saints. Paul?
It has come to my attention that it seems like the Church of Mormon has now become what is commonly known as the LDS Church, you know, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Is that true, and when did the name change take place, and was it kind of a ruse to get away from, people's negative feelings towards Mormonism?
Okay. It's a good question. The church has always, really from the 1832, been known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. However, there's been a big PR push, basically. So the caller's correct. A huge PR push in the last 15 years to sort of put Jesus Christ in boldface. In fact, if you go to the church's website, you'll see, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ, and that's in big letters. Because, yes, there was tremendous prejudice against Mormons on the one hand, and also Mormons are extremely defensive about being called non-Christians. This came up at a reading I gave fairly recently. They said, well, you know, how can they call themselves Christians if they say that Jesus Christ was in America, because that's not Christian doctrine? A point well taken. In any case, the Mormons hold themselves to be part of the family of Christian religions. I happen to agree with them, but certainly it's an open point.
Paul, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and we now have Rich joining us from Kennebunk, Maine. Rich, welcome to The Exchange.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Great program. I actually lived in southern Utah for a while, and it was kind of interesting. I didn't know much about the Mormon culture, but met a lot of great people there. I look on Mormonism as a very similar growth of it as Christianity was back in the day in Rome, when a number of religions were popping up every day and taking a little bit from, you know, prior religions. And I guess I just asked the guest, I'm really fascinated with, you had in that time when Joseph Smith was, when Mormonism was at its birth, you had a lot of these religions and kind of cults and things like that popping up all around the Northeast in that area, upstate New York. And I was just wondering from your guest perspective, from a higher perspective, why he thinks that Mormonism was the one that kind of stuck and just, you know, grew and is growing today and has sustained all this time. What are some of the key elements?
Great question, Rich. I had that down in my notes as well, so I'm glad we're going to get to it.
Yeah, it's a very serious question. There's a the Millerites, the Rappites, Anlie. There's all kinds of millenarian people running around that part of New York. I answer that question this way. First of all, Joseph had a Bible. You know, he had a text which people believed in, and no one else really made this astonishing claim, you know, that I have a third canonical piece of scripture from God himself. Again, we don't have time to debate the verisimilitude of that claim, but that attracted a lot of people. The Book of Mormon was, frankly, a selling tool and remains one to this day, I might say. Secondly, Smith clearly is a charismatic preacher. I mean, he clearly, and a charismatic personality. He attracts people to himself, which is powerful. Thirdly, Mormons from day second one are very aggressive missionaries. You know, we see the men and now the women who show up on our doorstep. They take the Book of Mormon to the people. They're always trying to build the church. And I guess I try to emphasize the power of, there's a fancy adjective here, I guess it's salvific message. I mean, the power of Joseph's message about salvation and also about the fact that Jesus Christ came to save us here in America. I think it's important and key that he takes these kind of shadowy events that may or may not have taken place, you know, in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, and he says, it's happening here in America. There are angels here. There are outriders of Jesus Christ that have come here to save us, and Jesus Christ will come here to America to save us. Join my religion, be part of my family, and we will greet Jesus Christ here, and we will all be saved.
Yes, a very persuasive message to a lot of people who uprooted their lives and moved west. Rich, thanks for a great question. Alex, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the title of your book, American Crucifixion. You know, in reading the book, you cite, I guess, what were contemporaneous or fairly contemporaneous reports of Smith's assassination in a jail at the hands of a mob. And my question is, you know, in sort of a Mormon church history or lore, how much has this kind of been reworked into kind of a, you know, a Christ-like crucifixion sort of story? You know, you have the governor of Illinois, Tom Ford, who's kind of a Pontius Pilate character. You have lots of accounts of Smith being very calm as he goes to his likely death. How has that played up in kind of the history and chronicles of Mormonism?
Okay, yeah, that I have to say that the title is my own, American Crucifixion. You know, I thought it was a great title. I saw that it could work.
Sure.
Fairly early in the game. As you know, there's even a footnote in my book suggesting that maybe this whole notion, Smith's quote, you know, I go as a lamb to the slaughter. I mean, mm-hmm. The lamb is, of course, a direct metaphor for Jesus Christ. There's a suggestion that quote might have been cooked. I mean, it appears repeatedly in his story. It's a little bit of my overlay because it's important to be fair to Mormons. Joseph Smith is not regarded as a deity. You know, he's regarded as a prophet, a man who spoke with deity. And this event in Mormon history is viewed as obviously a very important event. However, it's called a martyrdom. You know, Joseph and his brother Hiram are viewed as martyrs, and they're still viewed as martyrs. One thing I left out of the book. I don't know, rare moments of restraint. I mean, it would have been relevant to me to ask, well, does Joseph appear to his followers after his death the way Jesus Christ did? The answer is kind of yes and no, but it's he really appears in dreams. I think there's a couple of claims that he appears, but I sort of kept that out of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was kind of a very interesting lens through which to view the whole, the last part of the book, the assassination. Let's jump ahead now to the present day. You've written this, you know, very interesting and provocative book. You've explained why you undertook it. You're not a member of the Mormon Church, but you did research at a lot of Mormon archives. What has been kind of the reception by the community? Because you do present kind of a conflicted portrait of Joseph Smith. What kind of feedback have you gotten from the Mormon community on this book?
Right. First of all, I need to say that, you know, this is not some monolithic entity. I mean, there's what they call TBMs, True Blue Mormons.
Sure.
That's the sort of the church, the white church in Salt Lake City. The reception has been quite varied. I mean, curiously, my very first reading was to a Mormon study group in Washington, D.C., about 3 or 4 weeks ago, to 80 people who had actually bought and read the book. So that's so different, you know, from an actual reading where you're trying to sell the book. And those people whom I would describe as kind of very open-minded Mormons and very interested in non-Mormons who take on their history, they were terrific. I mean, there's kind of thinking Mormons understand that the church has not been 100% square with them where their own history is concerned. Obviously, a complicated subject. I should point out, you know, I mean, I'll give you certainly one example. That, you know, the largest bookstore chain in Utah is owned by the church, and they're not stocking this book. Having said that, you know, Brigham Young University bookstore is stocking this book and has sold out. So it's hard, you know, it's a varied response. This is not the book that Deseret Books, which is also a book publishing house as well as a chain of bookstores, they would not have published this book. It's not particularly faith promoting. It's just a little too nuanced for their, you know, rather rose colored view of Joseph Smith.
And so you've done this big project now. You said it took a couple years to write. Yes. Do you plan on doing more work on this topic, or are you now going to move on to other topics of interest to you?
I love Mormon history. You know, I just think there's so much opportunity here. I would write a book about Brigham Young and his war against the United States.
Are there any good books about that 30-year period right after Smith when they move out west?
Well, there's books about it. I feel that I wouldn't say there are any good books about it. A really meaty popular history that kind of embraces, Brigham, if anything, is a larger figure than Joseph Smith, you know, a figure of, I just love him.
It's just fascinating. I really enjoyed reading the book. But as you can hear, we are out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Alex Beam, for joining us this morning and giving us a really fascinating glimpse into the history of the Mormon Church. I learned so much from the book that I had not previously known.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for reading it. Yeah, thanks to your listeners who are really on top
of
this.
Great calls and emails today. And Alex, thanks for a very enjoyable conversation. That's Alex Beam, columnist for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Puglio. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in this morning for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The Granite State remembers and says goodbye to fallen Brentwood police officer Stephen Arkell. Governor Hassan signs into law a 4-cent gas tax increase effective July 1st. And after a week's worth of pressure, the Wolfboro Police Commissioner, criticized for making racist comments, resigns. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Ian Ream Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from your listeners and from Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings, frisbeehospital.com. And Tarm Biomass and Lime, supplying high-efficiency wood and wood pellet heating for homes and commercial applications while encouraging the use of local renewable fuel sources, woodboilers.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
and WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm. President Obama yesterday strongly defended the Department of Veterans Affairs. The VA right now is under heavy criticism with allegations of falsified records and long delays for veterans who need treatment. The president still supports VA Secretary Eric Shinseki. He said nobody cares more about our veterans.